It's an age-old American story. Trade secrets, corporate espionage, the battle for the consumer, and ultimately, the bottom line. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton speaks with a law professor and author about the battle between Barbie and Bratz, the battle over an American icon.
Hello and welcome, and thanks for listening. Silicon Valley, it's an economic engine of almost unparalleled impact, at least so far. Coal, shipping, and train barons from the Gilded Age might be the next closest things. Underlying the Valley's meteoric rise is a rather small three-word concept that frees intellectual property and creative ideas to flow from company to company, gig to gig. It's the non-compete clause or the non-disclosure agreement. In California, those don't hold any legal weight. Startups and entrepreneurs do not want to silo themselves. Talent can move from enterprise to enterprise and take knowledge with them.
The fact that employees can move freely, whole teams can move freely from one company to another and compete has been an integral part of the success of Silicon Valley.
That's our guest this week. She's a law professor at UC San Diego. She's a former military intelligence analyst as well. And her new book looks at how quickly things can escalate in the business world when intellectual property is at stake. And it takes the form of the ubiquitous child's doll, Barbie, and its rival, Bratz. And that conversation starts now.
Coralie Lobel is the Don Weckstein Professor of Law at University of San Diego.
Professor, thank you so much for your time today. We're going to get into the book for sure. It's called You Don't Own Me. It's how Mattel versus MGA Entertainment exposed Barbie's dark side, a wonderful case study and great research, great writing. But I kind of want to give a little bit of background, too. I was looking at some of your research and some of your bio, and it seems to go back to, you know, your military days as a military intelligence officer dealing with secrets, which, of course, made me think about trade secrets. What kind of led you along that path from military intelligence to law to studying the transfer of ideas and intellectual property?
I think the common thread is knowledge. How do we share knowledge? How do we keep it inside an organization? How do we collaborate and compete? And I think with everything that we're seeing in Silicon Valley and the creative industries, it's all about getting the balance right because we want to provide incentives to companies, to artists, to inventors to have some ownership over their ideas so that they can recoup, you know, some of their investment and their creative genius. But then we don't want to proprietize too much. We want to keep the public domain free and full so that we will build on those basic knowledge that makes human progress what it is.
Just to stay on a real macro level, because I'm thinking about in California specifically, there are no non-compete laws. How does a factor like that work into your thinking on secrets and the industry and IP?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you asked because before I wrote You Don't Own Me, I wrote a whole book that's called Talent Wants to Be Free. And it all started from that experience of me living in many different places and being a law professor sort of internationally. And California has that exceptional stance on non-competes where we don't enforce any non-competes. And more I was doing research and also collaborating and seeing research coming out from all across the campus, from business schools, from econ departments, that showed that actually the fact that employees can move freely, whole teams can move freely from one company to another and compete has been an integral part of the success of Silicon Valley.
And it goes back to the early days of Silicon Valley, too. As a culture, there were only X amount of human capital around, and they would trade teams all the time. They would go back and forth. We talked with another author about that phenomenon. Would you say that non-compete laws are not favored by incumbent industries? That's why we see a lot of pushback around it in places other than California?
Absolutely. So that's part of what the research shows, that places that have strong enforcement of non-competes and also strong enforcement of trade secrecy become more vertically integrated and more concentrated. And I think that's a huge problem because when, you know, it's just a basic economic analysis, when you have too much market concentration, there's less incentives to innovate and to, you know, introduce new products to be consumer friendly. The Treasury Department has become more aware of this. I know this because in 2016, I was invited to the White House to speak about my non-compete research and my previous book. And there's been now more and more states that are looking to Silicon Valley and to California's policy to try to emulate that position.
Well, we're in kind of a fertile field here. And if it's okay, I'll just go to table the present book right now and go back to your other book. Because you said something in that answer that intrigues me, which is the market consolidation. Now, you mentioned in Talent Wants to Be Free, that's a thought leader of a book, right? It's spreading knowledge and innovation. How are you seeing that when it comes to, let's say, Amazon, which has been referred to as a retail Death Star, and it's getting into its own shipping business now? How does your rubric apply to something like that when you think about market consolidation?
One of the things that we're seeing with tech is sort of the intertwined technology dominance and all of the different fields that the giants are getting into. So Amazon and Google, they're really no longer just doing what they started doing. And I actually just had a guest lecturer yesterday in my corporate innovation class that was talking about how open source is used and determining, you know, again, new entry, whether it's possible or not. And I think that those are great examples of how we might not be getting as much innovation and as much good prices and new technologies as we could if there was a little bit more pluralism in the market.
You know, another best-selling author we've had on here recently, Scott Galloway, argues that breaking up the four largest tech companies, not including Microsoft or Disney, into 11 different companies would oxygenate the markets in a broad stroke. Is that something that you can get your mind with too?
Absolutely. And this could be a good way to talk about moving from the tech industry to my new book, You Don't Own Me, which is about the entertainment industry. You said, you know, excluding Disney. In every industry, we see that concentration. And I think I wanted to write this new book that moved away from the very public debate that we have about tech and patent law and how these giants in Silicon Valley that really have been consolidating. Most recently, I've written a Harvard Business Review article about the Waymo Uber case, and now it's settled. And the settlement actually further concentrates that market because the settlement gives Waymo a share, you know, some equity in Uber. So that is, I think, a red flag as well. But when we move to copyright law and ideas and entertainment and the toy industry, which is the subject of You Don't Own Me, we see the same dynamic where in the toy industry, the more I dug in, it became clear that we have basically a duopoly. We've had that for decades. We've had Mattel and Hasbro dominating the markets, the shelves of, you know, the toy stores. And they have been using the law and also all kinds of questionable business strategies to really crush competition and crush smaller inventors and entrepreneurs.
So in You Don't Own Me, which is your newest book, it's Barbie, who is, you know, obviously the market leader for decades and decades, versus Bratz, B-R-A-T-Z. And as you mentioned, that's intellectual property at its core. What was the flashpoint, I guess you would say, that caused such pushback from Mattel and such legal and other very dramatic responses?
It's a fascinating story because Mattel has always pushed back on any artist, any musician, producer, and also competitors that try to challenge Barbie. So I actually start with this case that is just a roller coaster case that, you know, fuels the book, and there's very colorful personalities there. And I really wanted to tell the full story. But then I go back in time and show that history repeats, and it's been very much a pattern by this company. But in this case, it was the first time that Barbie really faced true competition because Mattel didn't know that it's coming. And suddenly Bratz was introduced, and as Judge Kaczynski, actually, who's one of the characters in the book, says, Barbie was knocked off her pedestal after 5 decades of dominance. Mm-hmm. And so that really triggered a decision when an anonymous letter arrives from Hong Kong. So there's a whole backstory about how Mattel discovers that a former employee of Mattel is actually the genius behind the idea for this new doll line that will really win the hearts of children. when they finally discover that, they make a choice that they are going to just use the sledgehammer of the court and litigation to win back their brand.
Did you find that there was a panic at Mattel? Because by that description, it seems that executives and lack of strategy could be blamed for getting caught flat-footed.
That actually plays out very interestingly in the case about what was the corporate culture before and after, before there was any competition of Barbie. And we see how there's some lack of leadership in innovation. There is, as we talked about before, there's concentration of the market. So actually Mattel talks about not wanting to cannibalize its own product. So really disinterest in its employees' creative ideas. And so many great ideas are left, you know, undeveloped. But then when suddenly there is competition, there's certainly a sense of panic. I go through internal memos and just really fascinating things that come out of the trial and the discovery, the phase, and also my interviews with the executives on both sides and the attorneys.
Given your significant experience in research, corporate anthropology, case studies, was there one thing that came out during the research for this particular book that you were like, I can't believe they did that?
Yeah, well, more than one. I hope the listeners will read the whole book to discover all kinds of things about the production processes and the question about deciding about recalls of, you know, toxic toys and the gendered, you know, consumer psychology that has been used over decades to sell toys, the racial and ethnic tones that are tone deaf that have been underlying both the corporate culture and the case itself in the trial. I'll point to one thing that really made an impact on the trial, and this is part of why I wanted to tell this particular story, which I think is representative of market competition in general, but it's also really unique in that the case was tried twice, and it was tried by a different set of lawyers, different judges, and different claims. And one of the things that you see as you read the book is how much personalities matter and kind of the backstory about the culture matter in the outcomes. And that's why there's all these twists and turns as you go along. So one thing that really stuck out is later on the discovery that what Mattel was accusing others or, you know, challenging MGA of having taken secrets from it and proprietary information. Actually, you know, there's a huge twist where suddenly the defendant, MGA, discovers that for years Mattel has been really spying, you know, unlawfully engaging in economic espionage with a whole department that is like the intelligence department that is, you know, charged to infiltrate and to get secrets from its competitors.
We're speaking with Professor Orly LaBelle. She's the author of You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. And it seems like litigation over inspiration, to borrow a phrase from you. I wonder, where could your idea of the diversification of knowledge, the spreading of knowledge, have intervened in this 10-year legal battle? I mean, if they'd have taken a different approach early on, what might it have looked like?
When faced with competition, the best thing, I think it's the best path for businesses, and I think it's the best path for the market, is to think about how to do things better. So if a company sees that its dominant product is suddenly overtaken by a new product, what are you supposed to do? The best thing is to put, you know, all the creative resources and all the best minds and improving your own product and doing something different and doing something better. I think we see this kind of, you know, inspiration versus litigation challenge in a lot of industries. And we can, again, go back to Silicon Valley culture where there's so much creativity, of course. But even if you take, you know, a single iconic legend, Steve Jobs, you see that kind of dual personality in him and in Apple, where there is that creative spark at the beginning of Apple and doing things better and understanding that ideas come from everywhere. And you can actually take ideas from the best ideas from other companies what we call intellectual property has its limits and run with it and just win the market. But then Steve Jobs, I think, is again representative of how at some critical point Apple invests more in patenting and going after the competition on the court front than actually innovating, putting those resources in R&D. So again, there are choices there. I do think that a lot of it has to do with market concentration and what companies could get away with. And also some of it has to do with how our court system works and our policies are built, because what the You Don't Own Me shows is that even when the claims are frivolous and even when eventually the company that's going after new competitors loses, it really, I think, can succeed in crushing the competition before there's ever a decision.
I am reminded when you mentioned Steve Jobs of the two different Steve Jobs, the first one that kind of quote unquote borrowed the graphical interface from Xerox, and then the one later who at a trade show screamed at the founder of Sonos that he was going to sue them out of existence because they had a click wheel on their hardware.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are other quotes that are just like, you know, you could put them side by side with Steve Jobs and you can see that tension.
In that last answer, you mentioned the legal process and the way the courts are situated. What were you referring to there?
Because we have intellectual property laws that are oftentimes fuzzy and, you know, beforehand and understanding what are the lines between what is protected and not protected. And you have this in every pillar of intellectual property, with patent law, with copyright law, with trademark, with trade secrets. There is some uncertainty about, you know, what will happen in the case of litigation. And that uncertainty is always playing to the favor of the side that has the most staying power and the most resources to threaten litigation and to, you know, go all the way through to really exhaust the other side. So what that actually means is that even just the threat of litigation for a small company, for a startup, for an entrepreneur who's searching for venture capital investment, it will mean that they might fold. I think that the big companies that have, you know, small armies of representation, like Mattel, I describe how Quinn Emanuel has been its repeat law firm, and it has a big, you know, general counsel arm, and it can just, you know, engage in a lot of litigation threats. It can really use that sledgehammer of the law in a way that doesn't really comply or doesn't look at what the actual outcomes or, you know, kind of the risk management of here's what is a real strong case. It can just use the law in a way that makes people really worried about even competing in any way with this dominant actor.
Professor LaBelle, You Don't Own Me is a great read on so many levels. It's a legal thriller. It's got so many characters in there, so much personality, as well as showing the market machinations. Wonderful work. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
That was Professor Orly LaBelle. Her new book is You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. Professor LaBelle is also a legal scholar and professor at the University of California, San Diego. Her previous book was Talent Wants to Be Free, a defense of getting rid of non-compete clauses and non-disclosure agreements with the express mission of oxygenating competition in the marketplace via the free flow of intellectual property. You can find links to her books and profile at KGORadio.com. Just look for the show notes story that goes with this week's broad and podcast. Coming up after the break, we talk about voice technology and what's heading our way when it comes to these talking robots that tech companies want us to put in our homes.
You don't want to beat people over the head with it. People get frustrated by that. And that kind of plays into the sort of the heuristics of voice, the CX around it. How do you do these things, introduce these things in a way where you are genuinely and authentically trying to benefit the user? If it comes off that way, you'll be fine. If it comes off that you're trying to benefit yourself, that's when you hurt your brand and your brand affinity.
That's coming up next. So please stick around. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.